Right now, sunshine, already 30 degrees in Racine, 18 in Kenosha, 10 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD HD. Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be talking about addiction on today's morning show, but not addiction in the way that we typically use that term. Today we are talking about addiction to food, and we are not using that term in a casual manner. We're really talking about how certain people's relationship to food is indeed an addiction every bit as powerful and, in a sense, inescapable as the addictions which we hear so much about, addiction to alcohol or to other drugs or to gambling or any other number of self-destructive behaviors. But today we talk about how one can be completely, literally addicted to food, particularly to certain so-called trigger foods, which can send one spiraling downward towards morbid obesity. It is an all too common phenomenon, but also one which is not widely understood. And it's also a phenomenon which does not seem to be deeply recognized by the medical community, which talks at great length, of course, and offers up all kinds of strategies and solutions for other kinds of addiction, but which tends not to want to address the matter of food in the same language. We have before us a book that does exactly that. That is, talks about compulsive eating as an addiction. The book is called Food Junkies, The Truth About Food Addiction. And we're going to be speaking today with Dr. Vera Tarman, who is an addiction specialist and, in fact, is the medical director for Renaissance, which is Canada's largest alcohol and drug treatment center. She has dealt with addictive behaviors and various addictions for a number of years and has come to recognize addiction to food as being just as powerful and potentially devastating an addiction as any of the others. So I'm really excited about this opportunity to talk about this very powerful book, Food Junkies, published by Dundurn. Dr. Vera Tarnum, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, hi, Greg. I'm really delighted to be here.
Very good. And I want to make sure that I remember to mention your website, which is addictionsunplugged.com, where, of course, people can access far more information. Dr. Tarman, maybe we could begin with the matter of the professional versus the personal. I know that early in the book you make a very clear statement about how you intended this book not only to be scientifically rigorous, but also highly personal and very accessible. Talk about the personal, the way in which this concern, this issue is a very personal one for you.
Yes, okay. It's interesting. I really debated whether I should include the personal piece, and I was really encouraged by many people, particularly other food addicts, to say, yes, you have to do that so that people can identify. And also, you know, there's so much shame around this issue, you know, of overeating and closet eating and, you know, the behaviors that go that we don't talk about, that to have somebody, you know, of your stature admitting to this will really push things ahead. So, you know, I'm actually quite private by nature, but I've decided to go for it. It is really the engine behind why I wrote this book, because what happened is I discovered early on, like in my 20s, that I had a problem with eating. I had stopped drinking alcohol, which I was doing a bit problematically. When I got into university, that just wasn't going to work with grades. You know, I was very ambitious. And what I found is that my struggles with food became, I hadn't had struggles before, but suddenly they became a real problem. So, which, by the way, I'll say that I think that a person is predisposed to food addiction if they have another addiction on board as well. What happened is I kept struggling, and I did seek out help, which in the 70s, which is when this was, there wasn't very much. The best we could get was a burgeoning new sort of professional category, what we call eating disorders, bulimia, binge eating disorder. And they didn't really know what to do with me, and I didn't know what to do with me. And it took me many years of struggling until I became an addictions doctor and focused on that. And it was like an aha moment. Hmm. It was this experience of, I'm going to treat these foods, particularly sugar, as a drug and stop them. Like I tell my patients to stop smoking cigarettes, just stop. Don't have one or two, you know, once in a while, but stop. And it worked. And, you know, the story would end there. But what would happen is when I would tell people, hey, I'm good now, and they'd say, wow, you lost so much weight and you know, you're better, have some cake. And I would always get drawn back in because we have this larger societal expectation that to stop a particular food is abnormal and we should be back to eating it, but just less. That didn't work for me. And it doesn't work for a food addict. And it was the passion around that sort of lack of recognition that has really fueled my, I guess I could call it a campaign on this issue.
Right. You are, I think, very wise in your book to make some clear distinctions. And they're probably really important distinctions to make given the culture in which we live, in which all kinds of attention is given to food, and with multiple television networks devoted to nothing but food,
yes,
and preparing the most spectacular foods,
yeah,
and recipes from around the world, and so on. And you are careful to say that there is no problem with enjoying food, maybe enjoying food a lot, or being tremendously interested in food, and even overeating, eating more than we should, is not necessarily a sign of food addiction.
No.
So where is that line where one is in fact talking about one's relationship to food being in fact an addiction? What are the most important signs or criterion for that?
Well, yeah, I really like your use of the word relationship because it really boils down to that. And in addiction terminology, we would just call that relationship an obsession with the particular trigger, whatever that is, whether it's cigarettes or alcohol or food. So a person who overeats and enjoys their food, you know, we call them foodies, that sort of thing. If they can stop when they're full, when they've enjoyed their food, their meal, and you know, now they're done, they do move on to something else, they're not likely a food addict. What we're really looking for is there that obsession so that even while you're eating the first meal, you're already thinking about the second. You know, how am I going to get from, you know, breakfast to lunch without eating? Life becomes focused around food, and it's particular foods. So it's like there's no stop switch. And what that line is that's never been a very clear line, even in alcoholism or anything else, you know, from heavy drinking to an alcoholic or recreational coke user to a coke addict. But there are specific behaviors that we start to see. And those behaviors for example, besides just are you obsessed about food and can't stop thinking about it, but, you know, are you starting to show sort of impaired function in your other activities? Like, are you starting to choose to stay at home with your ice cream at night rather than go out as planned? Are you starting to isolate so that you're only hanging around with your eating buddies or nobody at all? You know, you're by yourself. Like, a lot of people, that's their life, TV and food at night. And you know, if offered something else, we'll say no. Then, you know, do you eat differently in private than in public? Do you hide food, you know, because you don't want to have to share it if somebody's coming over? Will you steal food? Will you lie about it? You know, you're starting to see behaviors that are not typical of a foodie or somebody who's just enjoying food. It's typical of addiction.
Wow. At one point in talking about your own struggles and the recognition that you believed yourself to be a food addict, you at one point coined the term respectable addict.
Yes.
That, in a sense, that's one of the problems here. Although I suppose it's certainly possible some of the behaviors you just described, mm-hmm. you know, probably would look quite ominous to just about anybody looking on. But of course, addiction can also not go quite that far and be, on the surface, perfectly respectable.
Sure.
And that's the kind of addiction that, in some respects, we probably should really be careful about, because one is apt not to recognize danger signs that, in fact, are there.
I think that's absolutely the thing about food addiction. And even the danger signs that are there, we just don't call it what it is. We don't call a spade a spade. You know, when a person has a problem with food and finally enters the healthcare system, there's nobody saying, oh, I wonder if this guy's a food addict. They're saying, this person has obesity, they now have diabetes, they now have cholesterol, oops, they've just had a heart attack, I'm sorry, they've just died of a massive brain aneurysm or something like that. These are all consequences of food addiction, but we don't call it that.
We don't start there.
No.
And I thought you made such a good observation in talking about this matter of respectability, the relative respectability of most food addicts, when you said, in describing your own situation, it wasn't something where I had to go to some dark alley on the wrong side of town to get whatever I was after. My drug is everywhere. It was everywhere, and it is everywhere. You can't go anywhere without food being everywhere. And in particular, many of the foods that probably serve as these dangerous triggers.
Yes, that's right. Absolutely. I mean, it's a respectable. I mean, people laugh about it, as you know, I'm a chocoholic, which, by the way, is top on the list for addictive foods. You know, we talk about how funny that is, but if you were to ask a food addict how they actually eat that chocolate in private, it's not so funny anymore.
We're speaking with Dr. Vera Tarman, and we are talking about her book called Food Junkies, in which she explores the reality of food addiction, an addiction just as pernicious, just as potentially dangerous and destructive as any other kind of addictions which we might talk about. I think one point that is important for us to maybe return to for a moment is the distinction between overeating and addiction, because you say very clearly more than once in the book, overeating is not necessarily a sign of addiction.
No, you know, it probably is a sign that you're eating foods that are addictive, though, because it's not likely that you're going to overeat on carrots and Brussels sprouts, you know, even if they're delicious. You'll probably stop when you're really good and full. So if you do find that you're overeating, you know, like I remember one fellow telling me that he went to the Chinese buffet and was kept surprised why he would eat more than he thought was right. It's probably because the foods he is eating, I mean, they've been engineered, processed food especially, is deliberately engineered to be addictive, or what we would call in the industry hyper-palatable, so that they you know, the person is lured into having just a little bit more than they know they should. But that still is different than a food addict who has some kind of vulnerability, which could be genetic. We actually think there is a genetic piece to this, which, by the way, is the same genetic predisposition as other addictions. For example, the dopamine 2 receptor, there's something different about that for somebody who's obese and for somebody who's alcoholic. It's the same thing. So that's why I think that it's easy to have a cross-addiction. So there's probably a genetic vulnerability. I do think that if you're exposed enough, you can develop a sensitivity just by, great exposure as well. And that vulnerability makes a person get a kind of super reaction or a different reaction than just an overeater would.
Hmm. You talk a great deal in your book about trigger foods.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, let's begin with the term itself.
Mm-hmm.
What is a trigger food?
Well, okay, so as I was just saying, this is a nice segue into this. A person who has a vulnerability, one of the things that the terms that we use in addiction, which people don't really understand, is we say, you have an allergy to alcohol, or you have an allergy to something. I mean, there's no real allergy. A person isn't needing an EpiPen to, save their life. But what they have developed is a hypersensitivity to a particular substance. And what we identify as those substances are the trigger foods. It's like a particular chemical that you introduce into your body and you get an allergic reaction, which is a hypersensitive reaction, typically manifested as a craving. I want more. Oh, my God, this is delicious. I really want more of this. Well, you've had enough. No, I would like just a little bit more. And, you just keep wanting more and more and more and more of that. Whatever substance will do that is the trigger food. So universally a trigger food is sugar. That's because our brains are actually wired to want energy-dense substances like fat and like sugar because biologically it makes a lot of sense. So we're already in, from the get-go, primed to desire sugar. And if you give somebody a heightened amount of that, especially a vulnerable person, that's like a wow reaction where they just want more. So that's what we mean by a trigger food. What is the chemical that is inspiring that, what we call phenomena of craving?
Hmm. And are you saying that, I want to make sure I understand this term and use it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying that there are, in a sense, kind of universal trigger foods, that in a sense sugar serves as some kind of trigger for virtually all of us? Or is it that certain people have certain trigger foods and it's as though they are hardwired to react badly to that particular trigger?
Yeah, well, it's a little bit of both. And the hardwiring piece, I mean, we can become hardwired in the sense that our brain is plastic and can actually change according to circumstances. Like a lot of exposure, but just to go back, as I said, we from the get-go, our brains are already wired to prefer energy-dense foods, which is foods that have a lot of energy in them, caloric energy like sugar and fat. And if you design a product to make it like a potent amount of that, then you're going to catch us, any of us. Those would be, in a sense, the universal foods, so sugar and sugar and fat combinations. I'm not actually convinced that fat is. And really, this is a premature question that our discussion that we're having because food addiction has not yet been acknowledged clinically, so we don't have clinical research. Where it is being acknowledged now from an experimental point of view in that sort of preclinical trials. We're looking at rats, we're looking at PET scans, we're looking at a number of things that are strongly suggesting food addiction exists. Look, it looks just like alcohol and cocaine addiction. But we don't have yet enough to say, here is a definitive tool to measure a food addiction so that we can figure out that this food is addictive and this isn't. But I will say that we have a study that just came out actually within the last 2 weeks using the best tool we've got right now, which is called the Yale Food Inventory Scale. And they've figured out what they, out of the 35 items that they tested, what were the most addictive. And I'll tell you what they are because it's very interesting. Number one on the list was chocolate. Then within the top 10 was cheeseburger. Now, if this was a cheeseburger that you made at home with, cheese and your own burger or something, that probably wouldn't hit the list. But we're talking about processed food at a restaurant, which, as you probably know, is not just cheese and burger. There's a lot of grain in it. There's a lot of sugar in it and all sorts of other things. Ice cream, fries, chips, potato chips, cookies, pizza. I mean, these are all our favorite foods, right?
Mm.
Buttered popcorn. I remember thinking that buttered popcorn was a good choice to have if I was trying not to eat badly.
Hmm.
cereal. And think about what we give our kids. These are all top on the list of addictive items. Now, is it the actual cereal or is it the substance in the cereal? I think it's the substance in the cereal, whatever is being put in there. And we know there's a lot of sugar being put in there.
And I think what you're saying is because we're still in the very much preliminary stages of coming to understand this, that perhaps one of the things we don't yet fully understand is, for instance, exactly what is it in the pizza that is so addictive to us, or exactly what is the biological mechanism at play, or do we have a preliminary understanding of that?
I think we have a preliminary understanding of what the biological mechanism is. If we introduce sugar into our brain, basically, like I said, it's an energy-dense substance that we like, and the reason why we like it is because it fires off our neurochemicals, and that's what the research has actually been showing. There's particular neurochemicals that make us feel good. You call them the happy chemicals. Of dopamine, serotonin, endorphins, and these are highlighted in the brain. That's what's being tapped. That's what we're actually getting. So, I mean, when we talk about comfort food, it really does give comfort. And if you have a drink, you get that calm feeling. Everybody gets that, alcoholic or not. The alcoholic is the one that becomes dependent on that. But everybody gets that feeling. So when you eat food, particular foods, they are engineered to turn on these neurochemicals to make us feel comfortable so that we can self-medicate with them, for example. But it's just that the food addict can't stop with that. Need to self-medicate dominates everything else.
Then what is it that is the barrier that seems to be keeping the medical community from recognizing this? It seems like there is plenty of documentation then of what is going on.
Yes, that's a really good question, and the barrier is actually starting to break down right now as we speak. The DSM-5, which is the diagnostic criteria that psychiatrists use to diagnose, just got revised a couple of years ago, and in the process of revision, there are a lot of committees. It's a very political process. People submit, hey, can you consider this diagnosis, and here's the proof, and then there's a big committee that decides yes, no, this one will go, this one will keep. And what they told the food addiction advocates was, this is all very interesting, but give us more research, we're not there yet. So that's really where it is. Part of the obstacle is that we have a prevailing paradigm already to deal with difficult eating, which you mentioned in your preliminary talk, and that is eating disorders. So when in the 1970s went to the hospital to say, help me out here, I can't stop eating, people said, well, I guess you've got an eating disorder, and here's the treatment, which didn't work for me because I don't think that that's what I was. I think I was a food addict. And that prevailing, it's like with any other thing. You have a system that's already in place that's very well entrenched. It's very hard to then introduce a new idea, which sounds a bit crazy. You know, stop eating foods, particular foods. They don't like that suggestion because it sounds... It's not part of their plan, basically, which is to eat moderately.
You also mentioned the fact that, and maybe this is part of what makes the kind of the determination of lines and so on difficult, the fact that we are drawn to food.
Yeah.
And that we are wired as human beings to be drawn to food, to enjoy food, because we wouldn't survive if we didn't. I mean, when we think about certain people who for one reason or another have little or no appetite whatsoever, if that were the plight of humankind, we would be an extinct species most likely.
That's right.
So this is part of who we are. It's part of who we have to be.
Partly the reason why a food addiction is so hard to break, because our brain is actually, with another substance, it's hijacking. It's looking a little bit like something that's already in the brain, like we take an opiate pill, morphine or something. It hijacks an endorphin. It's not actually endorphin, though. But with food, it's actually, our brain was made for food, so it's even more sticky of an addiction, as it were.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Veera Tarman about her book, Food Junkies, The Truth About food addiction. I don't think we've yet clarified that one of the things that is an important component in your book is there is an array of real-life stories beyond your own struggles with food addiction, the stories of a number of other people with whom you have worked on this very tough issue. And one of the things that comes up is not only a number of different overeaters, but someone you call Deborah, who is battling anorexia, and you make the point that in a sense that is also a food addiction, kind of a food addiction turned on its head.
Yes, that's right. In that sense, you could argue that it's the behavior itself, because when we look at anorexia, what we see is a person who is obsessed about food, even though they're not eating it. One of the things, here's where we can really talk about the neurochemistry. One of the things is that when a person is hungry, you start to salivate and you start to look forward to food. You can't get food out of your mind the hungrier you are. And there's a little bit of a buzz that comes with that, and that's intentionally there to sort of motivate me to get off the couch and start getting food. Otherwise, I would die. So, and what's happening, I think, with anorexia, I want to make the distinction that I do think eating disorders do exist. I just think that there's a lot of people who might be misdiagnosed and are actually food addicts, like in the case of Deborah. Or it could be a dual diagnosis. She could have both, developed both. But that there's more than a bit of a buzz that's happening in just the anticipation of something rather than the actual doing of it. That's a dopamine high.
Wow.
Yeah.
You also tell the story of someone else, someone I believe you called Deborah. I'm sorry, no, Laura, who is someone who has wrestled with kind of dual demons, food and alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a story that is, in a sense, not all that uncommon,
no,
but that's part of what makes it an important story to recount. Tell our listeners a little more about this particular story.
Well, this particular story is actually the story of many people who stop drinking alcohol or even doing drugs. They find that they put down their drug, their alcohol in this case, and then all of a sudden now they're eating all the time. And I've actually seen people say to me, crack addicts say, look, I've just gained 30 pounds in 3 weeks. I'm going back to crack. There's no way I'm doing this. And it's not just because of the weight gain. It's the obsession about food. It's because, the argument is it's the same neurochemicals that are getting fired up. It's just a different substance. There's another example in the book where I talk about Harvey, who is a crystal meth addict, who said to me, that food, sugar, is harder to quit than the crystal meth was. Very common phenomena in AA circles, for example.
Right. And I should think that this becomes a really complicating factor in that you might have somebody who is, on the one hand, confronting the one demon, wrestles it to the ground, only to have this other demons spring up, and then the question comes up about which demon is worse, which path is more dangerous.
Yeah, and traditionally addiction programs, including mine, unfortunately, have been saying, deal with the worst one first. It's a bit like we used to say, don't worry about the smoking cigarettes, just quit your alcohol, worry about quitting later, the smoking later. And we've learned that, no, it's better if you just quit both at the same time. But we're not on the same board with food. We give people cookies so that they can get rid of a craving, and not a good idea. I wanted to make sure, if I could, to say something about the treatment of food addiction. Can we?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I just want to make sure, because I do want to have a message of hope at the end of all this, that I know a lot of people will say, food, how can you quit food? But I just to say that, as we said earlier, you can eat delicious foods, but they don't have to be foods that are, packed with sugar and, over concentrations of salt. and combinations of fat. Like, that's not necessary. And in fact, if we ate the way that we did 100 years ago, or just ate what we, you know, I think what we call, you know, green foods or real foods, we would be fine. You know, this is not a diet of calorie restriction. This is about knocking out what the trigger foods are, which might, like I said, universally is sugar, but it could actually be dairy for some people or nuts for some people. Find out what they are, and then everything else is fine. You just eat, you know, stuff that's not triggering for you. And if you can do that, it's actually a freeing and a happy life with food. You can actually enjoy food again, but not be obsessed with it.
One thing that really jumped out at me in your book was when you made mention of some of the important work being done by a woman in the nation of Iceland.
This is
funny timing. Where I teach college, I happen to have a student born and raised in Iceland. So I've thought a lot about the beautiful cold land of Iceland a lot lately. So this especially jumped out at me, but I don't know if the name Helga Gundmortsdottir, something like that?
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Okay.
Yeah.
But she runs a outpatient clinic in Iceland, working with food addicts. One of the things, and I want you to talk about the work she's doing, but one of the things that sort of leapt out at me was when I realized that probably more than is appropriate, I think of this almost entirely in American terms. And chances are this is maybe an especially rampant issue here in America because of all kinds of different factors. But it is a mistake to think of it as exclusively American. You yourself are not born in the United States. First of all, talk about the universality of this issue. I mean, where is it an especially dangerous problem?
I think that what we need to do is look at the maps that are coming out about sort of obesity prevalence. And the United States is definitely, I think, top on the list. And I think Australia is pretty much getting up there as well. You know, I think China is becoming more so, India becoming more so. And I think really if we want to be, you know, my book was never intended to be a political manifesto. It's a clinical, hey, look, this condition exists and here's how we can help. But there's a political message behind this, and that is up towards the processed food industry that's making big bucks off of vulnerable predispositions that we all have. Understandably, they want to make, you know, they want to make money. If you look at, you know, any of the societies that have started to adopt basically an American diet, we're starting to see obesity and we're starting to see food addiction. In Iceland, there is certainly not the prevalence of obesity, but there's something peculiar about the Icelandic people, that they're just very open, despite how small their culture is. They're very open to new ideas. This person, she actually got her training in the U.S. And went back to Iceland. And, you know, people have been very open to her. But I have people writing to me from Australia saying, oh, my God, we need this book. So I think it's just really where the food industry has developed all those tasty, hyper-palatable foods and introduced them to the inclusion of traditional diets.
One of the saddest stories in your book is about someone named Lawrence.
Yes.
And certainly not all stories of food addiction follow this particular path to this particular destination, if you will. Mm-hmm. But there are plenty of instances in which it actually does. And actually, one kind of wonders behind closed doors. You talked earlier about the seclusion in which many food addicts live out their lives.
Sure.
And perhaps this tragedy plays out far more often than we realize. Tell our listeners who Lawrence was and the really sad end to his particular story.
Yeah, you know, it is very sad. And I think that there are probably far more people than we think, because once a person reaches a certain weight, they don't want to go outside anymore. And then at a certain point, they really can't anymore because, you know, the chairs won't hold them and airplanes, forget it. You can't fly in a plane with the way the seats are manufactured now. But Lawrence was a basically initially a cocaine addict and was one of those men who tended to gain weight and used cocaine to kind of keep him curbed, keep his weight down. And then when he came from the States, New York actually, and you know was one of those wheeler dealer artsy kind of guys, and moved up to the Canada and somehow got into the heroin scene instead. I mean, because of his private use. And because he didn't have the connections or whatever it was, his art world kind of fell apart, but his drug use world grew, and he became a dealer of heroin, which will not burn off the calories as quickly as cocaine will. And people talk about the Jenny Crack diet, you know, especially in the addiction field, using those drugs to, you know, curb their weight and their eating. So anyway, there he is getting more and more in the heroin world, which is a much more drowsy, lazy, you know, just I'm not getting off the couch kind of world, except if you have to go out and buy, but he's a dealer, so he doesn't have to. He's getting it delivered to him. So he's getting his weight increased, and it increased, and it increased, and at a certain point, you know, scales usually go up to 350 pounds, and he was clearly above that. When I saw him, I'm guessing he was around 500 pounds. I mean, he couldn't even get off the off of his bed. He had to have an iron ring hanging above him that he would grab so he could hoist himself up. He used a bucket to pee in. He had some other guy who I think was just hanging around the house, like didn't have anywhere else to live, who you know got him his food and whatnot. And there was no way he was going to go out and see friends in that condition. But when you're in that condition, what was he going to do? I mean, it's not like you can only read so many books, watch so much TV. He would end up eating or using drugs. And when I saw him, he was wanted to go on methadone because he couldn't afford his heroin anymore. And to go into withdrawal, which, you know, with heroin is throwing up and diarrhea, and basically I think it would have killed him. He was in a really awkward state. But clearly isolated. I mean, when I was seeing him, it was hard to leave after an hour of a visit because I think I might have been the only person that he saw that day. Yeah, it's very sad.
I was reminded of certain television programs to which I must confess I have kind of a fascination that I'm embarrassed to admit. Uh-huh. Documentaries that sometimes take us behind the scenes of someone who is battling morbid obesity.
Yes.
And one of the things that I often find very striking is actually when you sort of peek into the life of somebody like that, that most of the time you don't see any books. Sometimes you see a TV in the corner, but I mean, and you never hear conversation about anything else. I mean, and in a sense, perhaps in part out of necessity, life becomes completely consumed by this one thing.
That's exactly it. You've just given the definition of addiction. Life becomes completely consumed around the object.
How does dealing with this addiction in your patients, how does this differ from dealing with other kinds of addiction? Because as we mentioned earlier, you were the medical director for Renaissance, which is an alcohol and drug treatment center. So you have this deep expertise in, let's call them the more standard kinds of addictions that we talk about all the time and which the medical community more readily recognizes.
Yeah.
How does this addiction differ from those kind of addictions? And are there ways in which it must be approached differently? Or is it essentially the same thing going on?
Well, I think it is essentially the same thing going on, but because of its lack of recognition, we miss it all the time and actually make it worse. Like, you know, if this were a traditional addiction, there'd usually be a protocol of how to, you know, withdrawal pattern, how to get the person off of the drug. We need that with food addiction. Oh, my God. Like some people, there is a withdrawal, and the craving to eat is so much. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have a three-week place where a person could detox, virtually not be allowed to leave to go and hunt down some kind of food, and just get help to help get through that withdrawal? That does not exist today. It actually existed in the 70s. There was a little bit more professional acknowledgement, oddly enough, than there is now. So that's the first thing. But what we usually do is, you know, person wants a donut, okay, have a donut. So we're not acknowledging that. Maybe there could be medication that we could target. There isn't anything. Most meds actually make it worse. So without recognizing it, I think we're actually doing ourselves a disservice. People don't know how to, like, they make the mistake of thinking, well, you've got to, you know, do calorie counts. But a good food addict diet or menu would actually be 1,800 calories, 2,000 calories, like any other good healthy diet would include. If we had just an appreciation that this was an addiction and applied some of the same tools that we use for the other drugs, I think we'd be in much better shape.
I have a couple last quick questions, and these veer towards the personal in my respect. I am in the middle of dropping a significant amount of weight because of some troubling numbers from the doctor back in January. And so I am undergoing some weight loss and actually having some very good success. I'm happy to report.
Yeah.
But a couple things in your book raise a question that it's not so much that this matters to me, but I think it's an important question that might matter to a lot of other people listening.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to certain foods that are being avoided for the sake of weight loss, like in my case, for instance, the particular program I'm on, I haven't had a sip of soda since January. I have not had a slice of bread. I've not had a noodle of pasta.
Yeah. Yeah.
But at some point, I really hope for the day when I can eat bread again, because I love bread, and I've always been sort of mystified by the notion that something that's been such a standard staple of diets for generations is suddenly something that I need to avoid for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
So, but if this happens to be one of my trigger foods, then maybe this is something, in fact, I do need to avoid for the rest of my life. How do you suggest somebody make those kind of determinations about something that really they must avoid altogether?
It really does come down to trial and error, and usually it's best not to do that little program of trial and error on your own, because we can talk ourselves into anything if we want to. If you want that bread enough, whatever you're feeling can be attributed to something else other than the bread. It really is helpful to have a food coach, or I mean, because we don't have this as an acknowledged condition, you're not going to find a doctor to help you. But there are 12-step programs that will as well. You know, the trial and error of you, if you are able to, on month three, let's say you've lost your weight and you're now moving from phase one to phase two of a diet, this is a sort of typical diet that people follow, where, you know, you introduce a few of those trigger foods. If you can stop and just you determine, if I have only one slice of bread a day instead of my usual four or five, and I keep my weight down, and you can stop, then that's great. Then you're not a food addict. Because to some degree, because this looks so much like other conditions, we don't really know what it is, if you have it, until you try the treatment. And if you find that you can't stop, you're probably addicted to that food, and you will have to stop the rest of your life.
Hmm.
But if you can, if you can stop, then fine.
You describe at one point a trigger food as something that ignites a fiery and voracious appetite that makes us want to eat.
Yeah.
If a particular food is your drug, any portion, large or small, will ignite insatiable cravings.
Yes. And now, the insatiable cravings may not appear all of a sudden. Like, if you stop for a while, it's not like you have it and go, whoa. I mean, sometimes that actually does happen. But usually what happens is you go, oh, wow, that was really nice. I like that. And then you think, well, I'm not going to have it again until next week. But you find on Saturday, you know what, that was so good, I'm just going to have one now. And then pretty soon, before you know it, this is all very insidious. If you find that now you're back to your typical four slices a day, there we go. And then what happens is, well, you know what, I think I'd like to have a little bit more peanut butter on this bread. It's an insidious thing that suddenly hits you, like, oh my God, and look at this weight, it's actually worse than it was before.
Hmm. I suppose this really underscores the really important matter of honesty, of being honest with oneself, of not hiding behind what we wish was true, but confronting the reality of one's life and one's own vulnerabilities. And we aren't always good at being honest like that.
And that's why I strongly encourage that you don't do this alone, because it's very hard. You know, one of the key cardinal features of addiction, it's like there's five cardinal features, and one of them is denial, where you won't see it when you're in the throes of the craving. You'll call it anything else. You'll call it, I have a headache and I have to have this now. You'll call it, it's my birthday, come on. Like, you'll call it something else. You won't call it what it is, which is a craving.
Hmm.
And rigorous honesty is the ultimate term, but we can't be there when we're in that craving place. It's
right.
Like asking a schizophrenic to recognize that their delusion is false. They believe it's absolutely true in the moment that they're seeing it.
Right. Well, we are given much to think about in this really important book, which again is called Food Junkies, The Truth About Food Addiction, a book published by Dundurn. And we do want to mention as well the website addictionsunplugged.com, which shares still more information. Dr. Vera Tarman, I so appreciate you writing this important book. I trust that it will be of great help to a number of people who struggle with this reality in their lives. And I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Oh, and thank you so much for reading the book so well. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a look at what resiliency is with former Navy SEAL Eric Reitens, the author of a book called Resilience. On Thursday, a largely musically themed morning show, which will include a conversation with a superb jazz artist by the name of Cyril Amey. And the Cyril Amey Quintet is going to be performing in concert, actually, at UW Parkside Thursday evening. Sponsored by the Kenosha Community Foundation in celebration of UW Parkside's Jazz Week. We'll also be speaking on Thursday with highly regarded composer Jennifer Higdon. Her work called Blue Cathedral is going to be performed this weekend in a concert by the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra. This work is one of the most popular contemporary works for orchestra, and we'll be talking with her about it on Thursday's morning show. On Friday, in a departure from our normal format, we're going to be giving way for a special edition of Education Matters. And you can hear on Friday a special candidates forum hosted by Dwayne Olson, featuring candidates for the school board for the Racine Unified School District. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock, and the Morning Show archive is located on our website, wgtd.org. Click on Talk. Support for the WGTD's Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Our weather forecast calls for sunny, cool conditions today with a slight chance of a bit of rain this afternoon. We're headed for a high of 39 degrees, cloudy and windy overnight, and a pretty good chance of rain, freezing rain and sleet with the overnight low 35 degrees. Tomorrow, Wednesday, will be cloudy, just a 20% chance of rain and a high of 49 degrees. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.